Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be interviewing Lady Glen Connor, who first came to prominence at the 1953 coronation, where she was a maid of honour, then was at the 2023 coronation for the King, and at the astonishingly early age of 87 had an extraordinary success with her book about her time as a lady-in-waiting to Princess Margaret, Lady-in-Waiting, My Extraordinary Life in the Shadow of the Crown. She's written six books in 6 years. She's appeared in four seasons of The Crown, and her latest terrific book is Manners and Mischief, an A to Z of a Life Lived Well. And it strikes me you're incredibly open. One of the secrets to your success, you're completely open and honest about everything. You've had tragedies in your life with the death of your two sons, and your husband wasn't entirely straightforward, but you're very, very open.
Well, thank you for saying that, because, I mean, I never, ever thought of writing. I couldn't write, I couldn't type or do anything. But my husband left a very unfortunate will, left me nothing and nothing to the children, and that's what I minded about. And I thought, well, you know, 87, how can I earn my living or do anything? Happened to be sitting next a lovely lunch in Norfolk, boiling hot weather, next door to a very nice young publisher. He said, what about writing a book? And I said, well, no, I can't. And he said, no, it's your voice. Plan it and then speak. And that's what I did. I think possibly that, and of course, you know, 87, out came this book. And it's now sold over a million and a half. It's been translated in 24 languages, including Russian and Ukrainian, which slightly different, because I get a lot of letters. I have to sort of answer them in a rather different way. The Russians get a bit of, you know, sharp end of my tongue slightly. And the Ukrainians, of course, I write and say how sorry and how awful it is for them.
But the wonderful book about Princess Margaret, you were completely honest about her, and you write about her very affectionately in your new book, but it seems to me you didn't mind things like, there's a good passage in your book where she sits and watches as you pack her bags, but didn't mind that.
I mean, I think what people forget about Princess Margaret when they complain, she was tremendously royal. I mean, her father was King Emperor of half the world, was pink. It was just her and the Queen and the four of them, us four, you know. And people forget, I think, how incredibly royal she was. And so I never minded. I mean, I quite liked the sort of royal bit. And it amused me. And also, of course, I didn't mind because she's such a friend. She's such a good friend to me. And when Henry had AIDS, which was like having a leper in the family, you know, people
would... Your son, Henry,
you know, and they would avoid one. My friends wouldn't come and stay. She always came. She brought David and Sarah. She hugged him when she saw him. Oh. And she came to his funeral. And, you know, just made, that's what a real friend is.
Yes. And you were very close to the late Queen as well. And because you talked very openly, but not indiscreetly, the royal family are happy for you to write about them in this book.
Well, you may have asked it, because I was a bit nervous. I thought, well, I'm not sure whether the Queen will be all that pleased. Luckily, I met Fergie, who is actually a cousin of mine, and she came rushing up like she does, said, one red-haired author to another, you know. So I was blasted into... And she said, I've just been... She used to call the Queen the boss. She'd just been to the boss. And she loved your book. She was roaring with laughter. So I was thrilled. And I sent off a signed copy saying, I'm so glad I liked my book. So it worked. And the thing about what I've written is there's nothing very important. I mean, they're not real secrets, you know. I write amusingly little stories about them, but I've always been careful. I wouldn't have been chosen to be a lady-in-waiting unless I had a certain discretion.
And actually, it's quite, as you write about in the new book, quite a complicated job being a lady-in-waiting. You had to marshal Princess Margaret, particularly around parties, make sure she didn't talk to boring people, make sure she sat next to interesting people, not always next to the bishop.
No, or the chief of police. when we went to these cocktail parties, I always had to... I knew who she wanted to speak to, or who she should speak to. So I would go and fetch them. And the great thing is to wait, because if she was having a lovely conversation with somebody, she'd be annoyed if I brought somebody else in. So one has to sort of wait and wonder at the moment when she'd had enough conversation with that person to bring the new one in. And at lunches and dinners, that sort of thing, I didn't sit at her table, but I sat quite near her. I had eye contact with her, so I always kept an eye on her. And the other thing, which a lot of ladies, because there aren't, I think Princess Anne has ladies in waiting, but the Queen has companions. And one of the things that we had to do, especially after Princess Anne, you know, was nearly kidnapped in the Mall, we were always told to just keep an eye out, you know. And I was with Princess Margaret on Bondi Beach, and suddenly this man came from nowhere. And he came straight up to Princess Margaret. And I was just there by, and I did that. And I think, I hope I didn't break his nose, but I made it bleed. And of course the security were embarrassed, you know. And I said, well, I was just there, you know. And I told one of the Queen's companions, was simply horrified. She said, obviously it meant supposed to do this. I said, well, I don't know, you know, if you're there, if this happens, yes.
But also it strikes me, it was very enjoyable, even at the very young age when you were, I think, you were 20 at the coronation?
Yes, I was, yes.
And that could be quite intimidating, but you say in the book it was incredibly enjoyable.
Well, because he was Bernard Norfolk, who the Norfolks always do the coronations. And, of course, one forgets that he had done the Queen's father just before the war at a very young age. So he knew exactly, actually, what to do. And he was a stickler. He was absolutely fantastic. And because the girl I was walking opposite me, slightly shorter, she had to have shoes that had a little heel. I had to have completely flat ones. And he told us all that. We had to wear one string of pearls, pearl earrings, and our hair had to be a certain length, everything. I mean, he was fantastic.
But it could have been intimidating. It strikes me you had a lovely, confident, open, happy approach to it.
It wasn't that intimidating because we were so well trained. We were trained like soldiers. You know? We knew exactly what to do. Although, I mean, when we stood waiting, I mean, the Queen, we hadn't said anything to us. She arrived on our coach, she got her eye. She looked fantastic. She looked so beautiful. Amazing dress. And there's quite a funny story, which I've never told, about her dress. Because Norman Hartnell had to have... on her dress, she had the symbols of Great Britain and the Commonwealth. Well, he put a daffodil for Wales. And he was told, no, it's a leek. So he thought, oh, God, how can I make a leek look attractive? Anyway, he did, up to a point. And the Queen, you know, after the coronation, went all around the Commonwealth, opening all the different parliaments. And she's standing, I was sort of thinking of something to say. She said to somebody, you know, I've got a leak on my dress. Of course, they were simply horrified. And it wasn't until she explained that actually, you know, what it was. But she had a great sense of humour, the Queen. You know, she used to laugh a lot.
And you've got a very good eye for the little things in life. Brilliant on the different waves of the royal family. Can you describe the different waves? You say no.
Well, that was a sort of niche sort of
subject. That was very, very funny.
I thought nobody. Well, I'm going to talk about. Partly, I thought about the waves because I've got a tiny thing of the Queen that's in my kitchen, and it's got a handbag, and when the sun comes on it, she waves. So every time I sit there having my coffee, and there's...
Is it a correct wave? She does get
yes,
it right.
Yes. The Queen's is quite crisp. The Queen Mother's is sort of stirring the pudding wave. Princess Margaret's more like that. But what I said, which I've never... I didn't really think... Writing books, for me anyway, is... because I don't keep diaries, is my photograph books. And looking at, and I was looking at the pictures of coronation, and I remember driving to the Westminster Abbey. My mother, who's lady in waiting, went to Buckingham Palace because she was getting one of the coaches. And of course, they chaired everybody. I mean, and it was so, and I did do a tiny wave. I thought, well, I'm not meant to, but anyway. And then on the balcony, I mean, how I didn't wave. I had to clutch my hand, because when you've got masses of people all waving and shouting, it's jolly difficult, actually.
And you also, because as you say, your mother was associated with the royal family, you must see patterns developing. Princess Margaret was a spare. Prince Harry has just written a book called Spare. Can you see parallels there?
Well, I sometimes when I talk, I say, because I, you know, was a great friend. I was with Princess Margaret for years and everything. I mean, she was a spare. I mean, when she was young, there were just the four of them, but she behaved perfectly. She was the most, you know, she adored the Queen. They rang each other up when they were older every day. I never heard her complain. The only thing she ever complained about that she wished she'd been educated like the Queen. Because actually, Princess Margaret was rather clever, actually, very well read. But that's how a spare should behave.
Right. And in your book, that's very enjoyable. There are serious points in there. You talk about primogeniture, and you're the oldest daughter of the Earl of Leicester. Do you never feel that you should have got Holkham and this enormous estate?
Well, I remember being a terrible disappointment when I was young. My father, you know, had Carey, my sister and I, and then there was a gap, and after the war, my mother had another girl. And I remember feeling really sad, because it just meant so much. And the title and everything went away to somebody who'd been brought up in Africa, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, my mother missed out, because she was the only child of the 8th Earl of Hardwick. So she should be Lord Hardwick, and if it wasn't for primogeniture, I should be Lord Leicester, which I would have enjoyed very much. I mean, I was treated as a boy by my father, in a way. I mean, I worked in the office, I went all around the estates, I knew a great deal about it.
And you wrote to Boris Johnson about primogeniture.
I did. Well, there were several of us, actually, who, like me, who couldn't inherit. We wrote to quite a lot of prime ministers, actually. Boris didn't reply. But so.
I know him quite well. It's entirely difficult.
Maybe he wasn't interested. I mean, again, it's a niche subject. And, you know.
He probably thinks, because he's the oldest son, that it's a very good thing.
Well,
As I said, you wrote your book in your late 80s. You came late to the limelight. Did you like that? Was it?
Yes. Well, because I was sort of used to it. You see, being a maid of honour, we were treated like a girl band. There weren't girl bands in those days. We were photographed. Everything we did was noted down. I mean, it was extraordinary. I mean, the amount of publicity we had. And then, of course, when I married Colin, again, big wedding at Holcombe, it was the same day as Princess Grace was married. And so there was a big wedding going on in Monaco. So the English papers used mine as a sort of perfect, you know, more simple English wedding. So I've always had quite a lot of attention, actually.
And as I said, you're extremely honest. You're particularly honest about your late husband, Colin Glenconner, who described him behaving like a toddler and having these tantrums, and at one stage sort of cuddling up in a fetal ball with anger. Where do you think that anger came from?
I mean, he had a difficult childhood. His parents divorced. He had a very, very eccentric mother. I think that his childhood wasn't very happy. But he was very good looking, very clever, and he made the best of it. But I didn't realise that he was like that. In fact, he'd had two nervous breakdowns before I was married, but nobody told me that, you know. And I wasn't really up to quite helping him in the way perhaps I should have been able to, you know.
Well, that sounds you're extremely stoical about it all. It sounds like you absorbed everything.
Yes, I did. I think the children were all quite pleased that I, you know. I mean, what saved our marriage really was he spent quite a lot of time in the end in the Caribbean. So we were apart some of the time, which made it more possible. But I was brought up, I was brought up in the war, you know. And people were brought up in a war. My parents were in Egypt. I didn't see them for 3 years. You have a stiff upper lip. You grow up very young.
Well, that comes across in your book, obviously from a grand background, but at the same time, it's in a good way self-denying. So you refuse to use handrails, don't you? And you go up the stairs rather than use the lift. So it's a really good self-denying sort of austerity from your childhood.
Well, you know, I mean, I did break my back earlier this year, but I was determined to get over it, which I have. I skip around now. Much as I can. And it's in me. You know, the reason I think that is I'm enjoying myself so much. I've never enjoyed my life as much as I am now. Partly in a selfish way that people want to speak to me, that they ask me to do things. I'm a great success. I've got so many friends. I'm a gay icon in America. It's amazing. I'm really enjoying it.
And you're very good on people who are. Let's say slightly more self-indulgent. There's an extremely good story in your book about Rain Spencer coming to stay.
Well, we used to have these big house parties. I could run the Ritz. Anyway, everybody, all the ladies, everybody arrived. They were unpacked for by a maid. And I happened to be going along the corridor where her room was, a frightful banging coming out of her room. So I whizzed down to the house. I said, what is happening? I've never heard such a noise in Lady Spencer's room. Oh, she said, didn't you know? She said, the rail in the cupboard is too low for our evening dresses. So she asked for the house carpenter. I said, I imagine she told me. So I said, no.
And with those things, you observe them and think they're ludicrous, but you're not sort of eaten up with anger about them.
No, I adore them. No. And I mean, that's why my books are such a success, because I see the funny side, you know. I mean, there is a funny side in those stories, you know. Lady Avon, you know, Prime Minister's wife, who actually, I now find out, because Hugo Vickers, who writes books, has written a book about her, and he rang me up and he said, I've got 200 letters among her papers from your husband, from Colin. Well, there I was, and at our wedding, he wrote to her on the Queen Elizabeth, on our honeymoon, saying, I spent all the service trying to see where he was sitting. He obviously actually wasn't in love with me at all, which made me feel better a bit, because our marriage hadn't got off to a very good start. And I felt, well, perhaps he was in love with Caruso.
Well, it's so philosophical.
But one has to have Avon.
Yes, I know that. Yeah. But you're so philosophical about these things, and you're philosophical about... Colin was this extraordinary entrepreneur, in a way, setting up Mystique, but burning through the inheritance and leaving everything to Kent. You seem to rise above it.
Well, at the time, it was very painful, actually. That was the last straw. I sort of got over everything. I was sort of loving him, the funeral, all that. And the will was read the night of his funeral, out in the Caribbean, it has to be. And I honestly say, it was, I couldn't believe it. And that night, there was no stars, it was very dark, there was no moon. And I remember going out onto the balcony, I just screamed. I screamed. And that sort of helped me. I thought I must get rid of this appalling, I couldn't understand what he adored the children. And especially Christopher, who had an accident, who we have to support, nothing.
Amazing. But you started over again.
Well, I started over again with my books, you see.
Exactly.
And I had a sale the other day in order to raise money for Christopher. I believe they got bids from all over the world. Somebody wanted a part of it, which is,
wonderful.
A bit extraordinary.
And I'll finish with, a couple of years ago, I saw you speak at the Chalk Valley History Festival, and on the same day, Antonia Fraser, I think is exactly your age, and I struck that both of you have this perfect ability to tell stories. You've talked to hundreds of people with no nerves, but a perfect telling of a story that ba-boom, 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 ba-boom.
She does that too.
No, but you both did it beautifully in different rooms. Were you taught to do that? Where does that come from?
I was taught slightly. I went to the House of Citizenship. In my day, there was no money. I mean, you couldn't go abroad to finish all. A rather marvellous woman called Neville Rove, Miss Neville, and her great grandmother was Pocahontas. her great great grandmother had gone to her, and of course, you know, Queen Victoria's fascinated by anybody from the colonies, you know. Anyway, she insisted on seeing Pocahontas. sadly came to London. Of course, the fumes and the she died quite soon. But a great thing about her great granddaughter was that we were taught public speaking.
Oh, really?
You know, and Glenn Carr, and Cook, you know, 5 minutes on the Firth of Forth Bridge, up you got. You didn't know what she was going to ask you, and you had to, you know, it was great training. And I love speaking, actually. I love an audience. I think perhaps we're both, we perhaps would have been actresses. I mean, I love the audience, and I try and speak to one or two of them personally as you're talking, so it sounds, you know, more. It was lovely. I loved the lunch that you gave me today.
Well, it's been lovely having you.
And I must be one of the olds. I mean, I'm perfect for you, aren't I? 94 next birthday.
You are a tremendous role model to all our oldies. And thanks so much to Lady Glenconner and her wonderful book, Manners and Mischief, an A to Z of a Life Lived Well. Thanks so much to Anne Glenconner for appearing on Radio Oldie. You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.